In the run-up to a general election, this all looks like an aim to gain more votes. If the appreciation is genetic, then can the ability to so easily remove ourselves, lose awareness of, and not connect with the natural world be genetic too?
This is the People's Countryside Environmental Debate Podcast with me, Stuart the Wild Man Mabbott, and him,
William Mankler. Thanks very much for being with us.
And we don't talk about the countryside as much as maybe you'd expect, because you, the listeners, send in questions for us to talk about. But we always try and bring it back to the environment in some way. Today, we've got returning listeners sending in questions. Alan and Vandana again. The last episode, they sent in the questions, and exactly the same two have sent in questions today, but completely different questions.
It's like deja vu, isn't it?
It is. So keep listening, and you'll find out what the questions are. And so we have a conversational style. We don't debate that often, and we don't often have guests unless we really think they're going to contribute and add value to a certain subject. We keep the big issues in your consciousness, and we try and break them down into bite-sized chunks and try and come up with actions to address what we discuss. We're just like you. We're two guys just trying to find a way forward. We don't see the listener's questions before we press record. So we come into it cold. But something I'd just like to promote, and we said about it last time, we got a new talk lined up in Rorton, Wiltshire, Wildlife and Everyday Gardens, Rorton Gardening Club. Having done a number of those talks now, what sticks out in your mind about them?
How different every single one is. Mm. The audience is such a big influence to the talks, because they are the ones that step up and say, "Look, I want you to talk about this particular subject." We give them a list at the start of every talk, and we get them to shout out the number of the item they want us to talk about, a particular subject of the wildlife and everyday gardens. Mm. But the audience, it's the audience every single time that really make the talk.
And to make the audience even more valuable for this podcast, please share it with five of your friends.
Oh, I like how you segue into that. You must be proud of that one, Stuart. But going back to the Rorton talk, that's going to be the third time we do this talk this year. We've got we're going to do this also in Steeple-Aston in March, and also up in Wardhorse Spa as well. So we're doing that three times this year, and who knows, Stuart, we might pack in a fourth one. Is that? We don't know who is contemplating getting in touch with us. And if you are listening to this podcast, get in touch with us and have a chat with us, and we'll come and do the talk for you.
Make sure you got deep pockets, though, because we're not cheap. Anyway, what's the first question from Alan today?
So, Alan, thank you very much again for your question. Alan from Northway here in Oxford. Alan said, in October 2023, Rishi Sunak, UK Prime Minister, cancelled the Birmingham to Manchester leg of the new HS2 Fast Railway. What's the point then of the leg that is to be built from London to Birmingham? And also dropped or altered a lot of policies that could help reduce the effects of climate change in the UK. In the run-up to a general election, this all looks like an aim to gain more votes. I ask, is it right to legally or ethically for the agreed timeline for the UK to meet net zero to seemingly be changed at will by the PM? This stuff has an impact on humanity well into the future. So is it time for the big decisions like this to be made by a larger coalition and not just one political party and one leader? There's lots to unpack in that question there.
Do you want to have a go?
Yeah, just starting off from this bit here where... Right at the start, in October 2023, Rishi Sunak, the UK Prime Minister, cancelled the Birmingham to Manchester leg of HS2. What's the point then of the leg that is to be built from London to Birmingham? I heard somebody make an argument about this, that in a way these extra legs were always going to be cancelled, because the thing with these big projects like this, big public projects like this, they become too expensive. And nobody really sees the benefit of them. It happened in France, where the high speed lines were originally built. Mm. The original plan was to build it from the centre of Paris to right down to the south, and only part of it got built. It didn't actually make its way initially all the way into to the centre of London. Okay. Sorry, to the centre of Paris. But what happened was that they became so popular that it became almost impossible to not extend it into Paris and extend the high speed line, the high speed network further. I think HS2, the biggest problem we have with HS2 is just how badly it's been managed and how badly it's been financed, though I'm not an expert in that, how it's been financed. But I think it can be the start of something bigger.
So even though it's stopped, you don't think it's a waste of time? I think you think it'd be picked up at a later date?
I think it would be just added to. And okay. Also, there was this whole idea, because when HS1 was...
And that's the point of it being built from London to Birmingham, then.
Yeah,
it still has value.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what's forgotten as well is that HS2, the clues in the name, people, it's HS2. It's the second high-speed line. The first high-speed line was built initially to Ebbsfleet down to the Channel Tunnel, and then it was extended into London. Initially, when the high-speed line was produced for the Eurostar in particular to go into Europe, the trains had to leave Waterloo and then follow the regular railway line until it got to Ebbsfleet. And it took about an hour, I think, just to even get to the start of the high-speed line. So the will then was there because people started using it, even when it was a slower service. And then HS1 was eventually extended into St Pancras. As a side note, by the way, that was one of the main reasons, one of the main factors that actually enabled the UK, or Great Britain in particular, to get the 2012 Olympics, because a station at Stratford was built, and there was a very quick shuttle service into the centre of London then because of that. That's my take on HS2 there.
But Alan is throwing the HS2 in the mix with other policies that Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, has altered or dropped that could have huge impact on the effects of climate change on the UK. And he says, in the run-up to a general election, this all looks like an aim to gain more votes. Is that why HS2 was dropped? Is that why all these things are being dropped? Or is it win votes, or is it big to keep? Because it's going to impact a lot of his friends in these industries that are going to have to change to become net zero or whatever we want to achieve. Is it a vote winner, or is it to keep his friends sweet?
The cancellation of these projects. Say, for example, cancellation of these policies and these projects. For example, the extension of HS2 is not necessarily. Let's not look at the cancellation. You should look at exactly what it's been replaced with. So, for example, he's been given more licenses for gas drilling, right?
Yeah.
So I can see that he's looking for votes. He's trying to gain, and how he's trying to get the votes is by short-term results. You know, he's talked about, you know, stopping the boats, for example. He's talked about halving inflation. He's talked about reducing the waiting list in the NHS. He's trying to make himself look as though he's actually getting things done. And HS2 is not something that will actually get, and it's particularly because that extension has not even been, there's nowhere near being built. I think the preparation work had started,
right,
I believe, but anyway, it's not going to happen within the next year. It's not a result he can kind of pin on a board and say this is what we've done. Or at least pretend that they've done, because that seems to be what this government likes to do, and pretend that they've actually had a result when they quite clearly haven't. But I think that it is trying to win the votes. It's what they've been replaced with.
If politicians are a short-term thing, like in the UK, they're 4 or 5 years, and then they have to stand for election again.
Yes.
Are they really the people who should be driving forward carbon neutrality or net zero? Because they're looking at things short-term.
Well, that goes. Yes, that's then is the political system rather than the politicians, because they politicians are unable, because of the system, to be able to really set long-term goals or long-term policy, because there's
so
always
should we be looking at them to maybe making these decisions then?
Yes. Well, then the question is then who makes those decisions? You know, who actually is? Are we looking at business? Are we looking at industry? Because their goal, business and industry, is to make money at the end of the day, is to build business.
And a lot of those are the politicians as well.
Yeah, they're definitely in there. I mean, yeah. That's a bit of a broad. I would say it's a bit of a broad stroke to say that every single business and every single industry is just after money, because that's not necessarily true.
Mm. So, Alan says, he asks, is it right legally and ethically for the agreed timeline for the UK to meet net zero to be seemingly changed at will by the MPs, by the Prime Minister? So is it legally and ethically right for him to change that? Just because he has the power to?
Well, yeah. He's got that's the power. But but you have to remember that he's also the power of Parliament as well.
Mm.
You know, these things have to also be discussed within Parliament and then have to be agreed by Parliament.
So, and Alan also says this stuff has an impact on humanity well into the future. So is there a time for the big decision to be made by a larger coalition and not just one political party and one leader? So,
what's the UN?
Yeah. The thing is, what I'm seeing is you've got the haves and the have-nots. What we have in this country is a consequence of 1,000 years of our recent history. And basically, you have the wealthy who tend to get the leadership roles, and everybody else is there to keep them wealthy, and to you know, it's not necessarily of societal benefit, it's to keep them growing, and wealth is hidden a lot. You know, people don't necessarily reveal their wealth or even who owns what, and that's a way of controlling the masses in many ways. Of you don't really know who's yanking your chain. But if you had a coalition to drive forward net zero or carbon neutrality, would it be the politicians mixed with business, with the lay people? And because you've got that hierarchical skewing of the business people and the leaders having the power, if you had the peasants on that panel as well, would their power be diminished within that, and you'd still have the cream rising to the top? Can you really have a coalition that's fair?
No, because or fair, but also powerful.
Mm.
Actually, have the power in the first place, because
it's not just talking; it's doing.
It's actually happened. You know, things like I said, we have that.
Mm.
We have the UN. We have the United Nations. That's what the United Nations Charter is.
Yeah.
Is to bring us together, and maybe. Maybe.
But aren't they run by the people with the power, with the vested interests? Is the UN made up of peasants, common people?
Yeah, but if
just
you give
throwing it in there, I'm not saying I believe in what I'm saying. I'm just,
if you give somebody power, then you know, that's always going to change somebody, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, regardless of who they are.
Quick question: do you know the difference between carbon neutrality and net zero?
I've never thought about it.
I was reading an article the other day, and I have to say, I'm guilty of not necessarily having thought about it much myself. Carbon neutrality is, from my understanding, and I'm probably wrong on this, you consume as much carbon as you produce.
Mm. Okay? Yes, that would be my understanding.
Whereas net zero, you are reducing the amount of carbon that is ultimately in the atmosphere on the planet. So you absorb
yes.
a lot more than you produce.
Yes. So you can, those two ideas can sit quite nicely side by side, can't
yeah.
they? So you can go for carbon neutrality of yeah. You know, they said there's the whole idea of carbon off. I imagine carbon neutrality is the same as carbon offset.
Yeah, pretty much.
That you. You know, say you fly somewhere.
Maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, whatever you want. But
yeah, whatever you want. rocking all over the world.
you can actually, if you fly, you can actually offset your carbon, that carbon footprint, or that carbon, with maybe planting trees, which I don't agree with. But, you know, it's like you can offset it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, an action I'd say with this is maybe look into carbon neutrality and net zero. And do they both need to exist? Should one exist Should they be merged? And, you know, are they pulling in different directions? Just look into it and just make your own conclusion. Just take your understanding of the subject a little bit further. You got an action?
No.
Okay. Now, before we move on to the next question, we wanted to let you guys know about our Patreon page. For as little as a cup of coffee a month, you gain access to loads of exclusive content. We keep changing what we provide. So have a look on there. Also on Patreon, that's where you get our newsletter for the People's Countryside Overall Project. Mm. The podcast is part of the People's Countryside Overall Project. And so if you go onto our Patreon page, it will be public, always public. Once a month, you get a newsletter. The next one, I think...
26th of February. Yeah, that's sure that's the right date.
Which is tomorrow.
Yes, indeed.
There you go. So have a look on there. You get all the information about what we're up to, what you can get involved with. So stop by. How can they find the Patreon page?
Patreon.com/thepeoplescountryside.
Okay, so now we've got Vandana from India. She sent in another question. So welcome Vandana, back.
Yes, welcome back again, Vandana. And you've sent us a run of questions in. It's really good to hear from you again. So Vandana, this is her question. It said the human species has 250,000 years of genetics running through its veins. Our universal appreciation for the beauty of the natural world comes from those genetics as we came from caves and the land. If the appreciation is genetic, then can the ability to so easily remove ourselves, lose awareness of, and not connect with the natural world be genetic too? If it is, then we are seemingly being pulled away from and pulled towards at the same time. Is it in our genetics to get the balance right?
I have no idea, Vandana.
Human progress has seen us progress from being people who live, animals who live in nature, who live outside, outdoors. Mm. You know, we started living in caves, and then we started to build our own homes, and then we started to grow crops.
Yep.
In
form societies.
Form societies and form cities and form towns and for our own safety. You know, the reason why we have a locked front door and windows and it's all about keeping the outside world out, because we still believe in some ways that it's scary and frightening, even though it's actually probably not as scary and frightening as we actually imagine it is.
Mm. I mean, she says there 250,000 years of genetics running through our veins. I know some people would disagree with that, and some people would disagree that we are evolved from other species, but genetics play a massive part, but so does the environment. Mm. When you study psychology, you realize that there's a lot of genetics and there's a lot of environment, but there's where the line is, who knows. The universal appreciation, this is really interesting, the universal appreciation of beauty of the natural world comes from those genetics, as we came from caves and the land. I'm not sure a universal appreciation of beauty comes from genetics, but our universal connection, whatever that means to the individual, our universal involvement is genetic.
Yes.
Appreciation, I'm not sure. He might be predisposed to appreciate or be aware. I think genetics are involved with our awareness, but appreciation, I think there's a lot of environmental drivers that can influence for or against appreciation. I'm not sure appreciation is as genetic as...
And the natural appreciation of the natural world, it goes... I mean, there's two parts to this statement, this question that Vandana sent into us. You know, the whole idea of... if the appreciation is genetic, that the ability to so easily remove ourselves, lose awareness of, and not connect with the natural world, can that be genetic too? Well, I don't know. It goes back to this whole idea of self-preservation. I feel as a species that we haven't really had to confront any. Well, there's been challenges within our history. I'm thinking of the mass pandemics that we've had in the past, and that nearly killed us off. and well, certainly definitely parts of the world were almost killed off. A very large part of the population was killed off. But there have no been, we've never had real extremes like extreme weathers, like really extreme weather I'm talking about here, you know, real proper 100 or 300 years of particular bad weather where we can't sustain ourselves. But I think we definitely have this sort of, I think our genetics is like with any other animal, that we it's all about the survival of the species. Because if you think about like this, so the appreciation, the beauty of nature, natural world comes from inside us. Mm. You can feel it when you go outside. It feels natural to be outside and in nature and green, especially. But then there's the other side of it, also saying that we want to remove ourselves from it, and that comes in the sense of like keeping our places clean and tidy. You know, and
controlled.
Nature is out there. It's not here. It's not in. It's not in this room. It's out. It's got to stay outside. You know, that's what we end up having concepts like vermin, for example.
Well, I'm reading one of many books. There's a book down there. It's written in about 1882. It's about tunnels and places that animals live in.
Okay.
It's their habitat, but it doesn't talk about the human species. Their habitat and the place they live is their homes. It's no different to a rabbit warren. Mm. It's still nature.
Yes.
But it says here, and in Vandana's question, if the appreciation is genetic on that assumption, then can the ability to so easily remove ourselves and lose awareness of and not connect with the natural world be genetic too? Again, I think genetics can give you a predisposition to lose your way and distract ourselves and confuse ourselves. But I don't think genetics... Well, there are some patterns of my thought. My thinking process, I could maybe link genetically to certain ancestors. But also being around my mum's family when I was growing up, that's an environmental thing that can give you some conclusions and habits and behaviours that you wouldn't have learnt if you were just left to genetics. Mm. You know,
you're talking about a mixture then.
Yeah. I don't think the ability to just remove ourselves and the environment is any more or less genetically motivated than our appreciation of the natural world is, because there's a whole mixture of stuff going on here, and we will never fully understand that.
Yeah, I mean, if you grow up in a say you grow up in a city with no greenery, you're in this really in an urban environment, and you're not exposed to any countryside or no greenery. Would that inherent appreciation of the beauty of nature still be there?
Mm.
It might be buried still, but it might not be there at all because you just were never exposed to it. I was exposed to a lot of greenery when I was younger by both my parents. You know, we used to go out for walks in the North York Moors, for example, or just down the local valley and up Shotover, and be part of nature and get muddy and get dirty, you know. Yeah.
Get down and dirty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it says the last part of Vandana's question: if it is all genetics, then we seemingly are being pulled away and being pulled towards things at the same time. Is it in our genetics to get the balance right? We are always being pulled to and from. Genetically and environmentally. When I say environmentally, I'm talking about like psychology. You get the environmental influences, the genetic influences. We are being pulled and pushed all at the same time. And is it in our genetics to get the balance right? It's in our genetics and in our environmental learning to try and get the balance right.
Mm.
But I don't think... The balance is the perfect equilibrium.
It feels like there's a conflict.
But how can, you know, you're not going to get the perfect equilibrium forevermore. It's just a momentary thing. Because if it was a permanent thing, there wouldn't be any balance going on. It's just there. Permanent.
I feel a conflict in us as a species of understanding the beauty and the value of the rest of the natural world around us. And then on the opposite side, you have this threat to us, you know, or perceived threat to the human species of, and that's why we like to lock ourselves away. That's why some people just don't like green. They don't like this. They don't like it around them. They want a very clean and neat and tidy garden.
And that's down to genetics and environmental influences as well.
Absolutely, yeah. But whatever the source of it is, it's there. You know, that confrontation. They don't want it at their door. Mm. You know, when they see, like I said, I'll use the phrase vermin, because vermin is basically an animal that is undesired in a household or around a household. But they're still wild animals. They're still natural. They're there for a reason, aren't they?
Exactly. So so an action there is just to look in your own life and see what could be genetic and what could be environmental, and what percentage does each have. And I think in different areas the percentage will change. But I think on balance, environmental influences have a massive impact on us.
Yeah, my action is to get out there and see the world.
And some people would say the genetics are the truth, but it's very hard to know, should we be more focused on our genetics and then...
I think it gets you, but I can get really bogged down in it, can't you?
Yeah, there's no answer to this.
I said my action is as we have said in the past, is to get out there and just experience the world, and particularly experience the natural world around us.
Mm.
One thing is you don't know how long it's going to be around.
No.
And the other thing is that if you do feel that sort of that disconnection from it, and feel that there's a fear of that.
Yeah.
The best way is to go out there and I would say confront the fear, because that's often it doesn't always work, but there's always look for green spaces in where you live.
Yeah, explore that.
Explore them. So they can be the smallest green space you can think of, you know. Mm. But just go and explore it, and go and explore how you're feeling it.
Something else I'd suggest you explore: we're running a Just Giving fundraiser.
Yes,
and
to get you an Extreme 8.
Wheelchair.
All terrain, all singing, all dancing, four-wheel drive.
Wheelchair.
You're going to get a 4x4, Stuart.
Effectively.
How do you feel about it? You're going to be middle class, maybe.
Living in Hereford. Anyway, so we've already achieved a lot. There was a Q50R indoor wheelchair with some outdoor capacity, various other devices we've managed to raise money for. But we're aiming at 23,000 to get this all-terrain wheelchair. So basically, I can continue doing the outdoor education work that William and I do together and separately.
Yes.
And the first chair, basically, I'm going to read this from the fundraiser. It says, "In a world full of barriers, it offers me a sanctuary to start working from again and enables me to actively go out networking to generate more work opportunities and to secure further donations towards purchasing this all-terrain chair. Now, the all-terrain chair will then be relied upon to undertake aspects of the outdoor education work." So this podcast is just part of what we do. Now, the fundraiser is, if you go online, justgiving.com/crowdfunding/wildmanonwheels, you can have a look at that. And please do put in a little, throw some money in the pot. And you'd be surprised at how momentum builds and away we go.
Now, part of what we're doing with these wheelchairs is looking at accessibility in general, aren't we?
Yeah.
How accessibility to the natural world, to nature, is not always just looking at what happens when you get there, but actually when you're in the actual, when you're in these places, nature reserves, etc., is actually being able to get there and get into it in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. We're looking to collaborate with the Earth Trust in Oxfordshire, basically to make them an accessibility hub, basically showcasing that it doesn't have to cost the Earth to make nature accessible. Small changes can make a big difference, and we need to help everybody get out into nature. Now, somebody said, oh, because they saw me in a wheelchair, they thought I was paralysed. That's an assumption. There's an assumption about how people with accessibility issues getting out into the countryside. It's not just mobility. It can be cognitive. It can be sight. It can be hearing. You know, there's all sorts of different... And well, what do people need to be able to get out into the countryside? Ask us!
The path of this wheelchair, that's just a phrase that's just popped into my head. So the current one, the Q50R, it's definitely... You know, we've been out several times together with you using it, Stuart. And the one thing it's really made me aware of is just, you know, just the challenges for that wheelchair and challenges it presents you.
I'm having to relearn Oxford because when I'm sat in the chair going around the streets, I'm looking from the streets from a much lower perspective because I'm sat in the chair. And I'm seeing contours that people don't notice.
You just don't notice, you can just walk on it over on a daily basis. But the Extreme 8 wheelchair will also have that impact. The impact will be beyond you because we're looking at this whole idea of disability access to places and what are the barriers and how can we get past those barriers, and not just for somebody like yourself who needs access to a wheelchair, but as you say, everybody, the whole spectrum of disability really.
Yeah, so this fundraiser isn't about making my life easier. It's about making me able to keep doing what we do and provide the service we do, getting people out into nature.
Yeah, I'm pushing it as well. I'm pushing the idea of that it needs to be accessible to anybody, everybody, all the time.